headlines, Iran's most senior military commander visits an underground base which houses a huge fleet of cutting-edge Iranian drones. One day ahead of Israel's flag march, Palestinian groups warn they are ready for confrontation as Israel refuses to change the planned route. Also, heavy fighting is underway in eastern Ukraine, where Russian forces are advancing amid a possibility of a partial Ukrainian retreat. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Iran's most senior military commander has visited one of the secret bases of the army. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghari, paid a visit to an underground drone base. The top general got a first-hand account of the Iranian army's cutting-edge capabilities in the development of different types of military combat and long-range drones. Images released show the Kaman 12 drone, with a flight endurance of 12 hours and capable of carrying four domestically produced bombs and missiles. With this secret base becoming operational, Iran has turned into the top drone power in the region. The fate of the 2015 Iran deal remains far from clear as talks between Tehran and the P4+1 group are stalled. As we will see in this next report, Iran says the main remaining issue in the talks is about its right to economic and trade benefits under the JCPOA.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. list of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations.
Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian stresses that what has caused a pause in the negotiations is Iran's economic and trade demands, and the most important remaining issue is the effective removal of economic sanctions. The top diplomat says the maximum pressure campaign launched by former U.S. President Donald Trump must end. He says the window of diplomacy is still open, adding that Americans know what they need to do.
U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
Palestinian resistance groups warn Israel ahead of the regime's provocative flag march in occupied Al-Quds. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Palestinian groups say they would retaliate if Israel does not change the planned route of the parade and it tries to approach Al-Aqsa Mosque. People's Youth Movement in Al-Quds says it wants Sunday to be remembered as Palestinian Flag Day by raising the national flag on every house, square, and street. Israeli groups hold annual events to commemorate the occupation of the Old City and other Palestinian neighborhoods in 1967. A similar rally last year ended with Israeli crackdown and retaliatory rocket attacks by Hamas that led to an 11-day war on Gaza. Regime officials say a series of raids and arrests are expected across the occupied territories ahead of a planned march. A pro-Palestinian Church of England priest has faced a disciplinary tribunal in London over the past week for criticizing Israel and for what he calls Christian Zionist support for it. This comes after renewed complaints of anti-Semitism against Reverend Stephen Sizer by a Jewish group in Britain, Saipur Aza reports.
What they lack in number, they make up for in solidarity. Supporters of a British pro-Palestine priest facing a week-long Church of England tribunal here for his views on Israel. 68-year-old Reverend Stephen Sizer, a retired Anglican vicar known for his opposition to Christian Zionism, a belief among some Christians that the establishment of Israel in 1948 was in accordance with biblical prophecy, accused of anti-Semitism.
We're concerned about how people who are speaking up against the crimes against humanity that are being committed by apartheid Israel are being targeted. And people and organizations in this country that are apologists for apartheid, that are actually supportive of the apartheid state of Israel, are actually using regulatory processes to actually target individuals and stop any kind of dissent from being said.
One such group, the Pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews. that's accused Dr. Sizer of making public statements that conflicts with the so-called International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism adopted by the Church of England. The definition conflates harsh criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
There's no exemption from their attempt to shut down pro-Palestinian discourse. And the reason's very simple. They've lost the debate. If they were winning the debate, they wouldn't be trying to shut down Stephen Sizer, but they know that public opinion, because of what Israel does and because of the Palestinian resistance, they know that they're very, very unpopular in public opinion.
And it's not the first time this is happening. Dr. Sizer faced similar accusations in 2013, but was exonerated in return for not posting about Palestine on social media. Nearly 10 years later, he's once again the subject of a pro-Israel witch hunt.
A final verdict is expected in the coming weeks, but what this case and similar ones show, these activists say, is the length to which the British state will go in silencing all criticism of Israel and its apartheid against Palestinians. Saeed Bourza, London.
Ukraine's president says his country will do whatever it takes to defend the eastern region of Donbass, where Russian forces are conducting a fierce offensive. Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Moscow of carrying out genocide in Donbass. He says that Russians have concentrated maximum artillery and reserves in the region, targeting it with missiles and strikes and aircraft attacks. Fighting in Donbass has been raging over the past few weeks. Some Ukrainian officials say that Kiev's troops may now have to retreat from some key areas to avoid being captured. Some 10,000 Russian troops are reportedly stationed in Donbass. That makes up for the Donetsk and Luhansk provinces. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us from Donetsk province in eastern Ukraine with details on the situation. Let's take a listen.
The long-awaited, the long-talked-about encirclement of Ukrainian troops in the Donbass looks like it's happening. And while there's been many Ukrainian units over recent days posting on the internet saying that they are refusing to fight, even from the official hierarchy now, they're saying that they're looking at a full withdrawal. NATO is still determined to supply Ukraine with weapons, particularly the United States and Britain. There's been a number of weapon systems delivered to the Ukrainians over recent weeks and months, which were supposed to be game changers. That hasn't happened. Well, the Americans are now saying they're going to send high-tech, long-range artillery. So we'll have to see whether that changes anything. But also, there's interestingly a bit of a split within NATO. While Britain, France, Poland, some of the Baltic states like Estonia seem determined to do whatever they can to help Ukraine defeat Russia, powerhouses of the EU, France and Germany, are less interested in supporting Ukraine.
North Korea has reported a drop in the number of new fever cases it is battling as it first announced a COVID outbreak at the beginning of the pandemic. Local media say over 88,500 people showed fever symptoms on Friday. The figure dropped to below 100,000 for the first time since North Korea began reporting daily new cases on May 12th. No additional deaths have so far been registered. The country has logged over 3.4 million fever cases and 69 deaths. 2 weeks ago, Pyongyang declared a state of emergency and imposed a national lockdown after it confirmed its first COVID cases. The government says the COVID outbreak is now under control. The United States has hit North Korea with new sanctions over its nuclear and missile program. The U.S. Treasury Department says it has blacklisted two Russian banks and a North Korean company and an individual. It said Washington would continue to implement sanctions but urged the North to return to a diplomatic path. The move came a day after China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push for more U.N. sanctions over North Korea's missile launches. In a joint statement later, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea strongly condemned the North's recent ballistic missile launches. Talks on Pyongyang's denuclearization have been stalled since a summit with the U.S. collapsed in 2019. North Korea says its nuclear and missile programs are counter-hostile U.S. policies. A key member of the Japanese Red Army, a group known for its anti-imperialistic efforts, has been released from prison after 20 years. Fusako Shigembu, 76 years old, was released on Saturday after serving her sentence. She was arrested in Osaka over the siege of the French embassy in Japan in 1974. She was accused of helping coordinate the attack. She is the co-founder of the Japanese Red Army that was formed in 1970. The group advocates toppling the Japanese monarchy and was a supporter of the Palestinian cause. In an interview with the UK-based Guardian newspaper, she expressed support for Palestinian people and her intent to help them. Participants at the fourth regional security dialogue on Afghanistan have called for the establishment of a broad-based government in that country. The summit took place in Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, on Friday. Top security officials from Iran, Russia, India, China, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan were in attendance. They issued a final statement dismissing any foreign interference in Afghanistan's internal affairs. The statement said that all sides should continue to hold talks and engage with Kabul. This aims to help Afghanistan adopt a stable domestic and foreign policy and enhance cordial ties with all countries in the region. It also calls on the Taliban to respect people's rights and freedoms, irrespective of their ethnicity. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. In my opinion, there are two important qualities that constituted his personality. One is his firm determination and another is his insight. We must promote these qualities as much as we can. One is firm determination. Sometimes we believe in something but do not act on it because of our weak willpower. Having a firm willpower plays a decisive role. Hazrat Hamza became a Muslim in the 8th year of the Holy Prophet's Ba'tha. Those days were the hardest days for the Holy Prophet because Islam had just become announced publicly and the Holy Prophet and his companions were being attacked from all sides. The hardships that we have heard of are related to those years. During those very difficult circumstances for Muslims, that personality shouted in Masjid al-Haram next to Kaaba that he had become a Muslim and that he had believed in the Holy Prophet's religion. Such was his courage, his firm determination, and his insight.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Gaining a correct understanding of things is very important. We should teach ourselves and our people to think carefully on various matters and to make a correct decision. Had we but listened or used our intelligence, we should not now be among the companions of the blazing fire. They will then confess their sins. Chapter 67, verses 10 to 11. If we do not listen and think carefully, this is a sin. The Holy Quran says this clearly. According to the Commander of the Faithful, as quoted by Imam Baqir alayhi salam, peace and greetings be upon him, Hazrat Hamza was a manifestation of among the believers of men who have been true to their covenant with God. How does being true to their covenant with God take place? The full and complete form of it is to become a role model for divine teachings and divine commands and stepping forward for the path that God has specified. That is, such personalities become a manifestation of these qualities. We should learn this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
According to the latest Global Terrorism Index, there is an increase in terrorist attacks across sub-Saharan Africa amid concern that the region is now becoming the center of operations by armed groups affiliated to Daesh or ISIS and Al-Qaeda terrorist groups. Now, Western countries such as France and the United States have troops in Africa to ostensibly combat terrorists. However, due to an upsurge in terrorism, many in the continent are now questioning the real reasons behind the presence of these foreign troops. Meanwhile, civilians, especially women and children, are bearing the brunt of terrorist attacks in Africa. A Nigerian woman who is a victim of Boko Haram terrorist group speaks here inside a refugee camp. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on an upsurge of terrorist attacks in Africa, especially in the volatile Sahel region. We are asking, what are the factors behind increasing terrorist attacks in the continent and how are Western imperialist powers linked to this deteriorating situation? In the second part of our program, we shall discuss the situation in Mali as the country's government pursues an independent policy. We are asking, is France, the former colonial power, undermining the government of Mali? Now, these are some of the questions our experts will be answering today.
An upsurge of terrorism in Africa. The 2022 Global Terrorism Index reveals that terrorism remains a serious threat, with sub-Saharan Africa accounting for 48% of total global deaths from terrorism. Four of the 10 countries with the largest increases in deaths from terrorism were also in sub-Saharan Africa, namely Niger, Mali, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burkina Faso.
Following military defeats in Syria and Iraq, the notorious Daesh terrorist group shifted its attention to Africa's Sahel region, which is now the epicenter of terrorism. Grassroots Mozambique in Southern Africa also witnessed deadly terrorist attacks over the last few years. A Mozambican here gives an account of his daring escape during a terrorist attack in the country's restive Cabo Delgado province.
Mesmo assim, no dia do ataque, aquilo aconteceu enquanto já estive no centro de trabalho, estive trabalhando numa certa empresa. Então, quando aquilo aconteceu, eu logo já me escapei de lá, entrando na mata, já procurando refúgio. Então, até o momento, já não sei onde é que a minha família está.
Well, to discuss increased terrorism in Africa and possible factors behind it, we contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time and for joining our program.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Freeman, are you surprised that there is an outbreak of terrorism in Africa and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to recognize that the root causes of terrorism in Africa haven't been addressed. The root causes stem out of the legacy of how Europe underdeveloped Africa. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, if we believe that there are no really inferior people and the African people are not inferior, then we got to say that this comes from somewhere and it has to have its legacy in the underdevelopment that has been put on Africa by the Western countries, and that those conditions, the lack of self-determination and being dominated by the Western world still exists. As a result of that, there's marginalization, there's economic despair in people. We know that there are high levels of unemployment.
Most of the terrorist groups operating in Africa, such as Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, are linked to global terror networks, especially Daesh and Al-Qaeda, all which follow the extremist Wahhabi ideology. Several reports link Wahhabi donors in Persian Gulf monarchies to these terrorist groups. What are the other sources of funding for these terrorists that are well-armed and apparently powerful?
It's a good question. I know that the funding sources are as elusive as the terrorist people can be themselves. And so, but we know that there's a lot of the informal cash-based economies of a lot of the countries and the regions that make it possible for countries to have, like, for groups like Boko Haram or whoever to use couriers to move cash within the borders of a country, like say from Nigeria or across the borders. The borders in Africa are very porous, as we say. And so the neighboring countries, so it's easy to move cash around. There have been reports that even I think it was Boko Haram that was able to actually raise like $70 million between 2006 and 2011. These things still exist in various illicit sources of funding operating in what I would refer to as the underworld economy. A lot of people call it just criminal, but you know, I mean. The only reason I hesitate to use criminals because who's judging who is the criminals? A lot of the imperialists and what they do is not seen as criminal. I see it as criminal. So I just, you know, I'd rather not, you know, use that word for them, but underworld economies.
By the way, just to add on to what Mr. Freeman said, lest we forget, Donald Trump, during his campaigns before being elected the U.S. president, said that President Barack Obama was the founder of ISIS or Daesh, along with Hillary Clinton.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Despite the presence of mostly Western forces in Africa to purportedly combat terrorist groups, there is an increase in terrorist attacks in Africa. For instance, there are some 6,000 American troops, Defense Department civilians, and contractors across Africa. Recently, President Joe Biden also approved a redeployment of 500 U.S. troops in Somalia. Now, what exactly are these foreign troops doing in Africa since they have been unable to dismantle terrorist groups?
Actually, the fact that they that their groups do exist gives them the excuse they need to continue their occupation. This is a boom for the defense industries, They get to sell weapons to the African governments. They get to use their own weapons and make sure the people are the special forces and AFRICOM and the French Foreign Legion, all those are well equipped and have the most sophisticated weapons. So the military industrial complex, I would say, is a big part of what's happening here. I mean, we could see the militarization of the world. Divorce the extremism, radical extremism, from the West's militarization of the world, particularly the United States. You know, that's all it seems to offer the world. Then there's also the fact that this militarism and the presence of the West within these countries secures what Africa has been used for all along as a source of raw materials for the use of the Western world. So the hegemony of the West and the free flow of the raw materials in Africa is a strong reason, a big reason, and admittedly so by them, for their presence in Africa.
Factors such as poverty and marginalization are said to be some of the underlying reasons that attract African youths to terrorism and extremist ideologies. Why have African governments failed to tackle some of the challenges that push mostly young people to terrorism?
Africa itself and the states in Africa, the people of Africa, are not controlling their own politics and their own economics, distribution, land, all that. It's under the control of the West and foreigners. And so this is neocolonialism. Neoliberalism is that model of economics that puts profit over anything else. It values things based on profit and levels policies like austerity and privatization.
Speaking early May during a visit to Borno, a northern Nigerian state that has been targeted many times by Boko Haram terrorists, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for global efforts to tackle terrorism.
To support humanitarian action in Borno, must to recognize the enormous challenges that Borno faces with climate change, with still Boko Haram active, even if weakened, and to invest in the Borno of hope.
Now, quite clearly, terrorism is a global phenomenon. Now, what needs to be done for better international collaboration in tackling this evil?
The international level, there needs to be, and there actually are moves to do it, a reemergence of the non-aligned movement. If we remember back in the 50s and into the 60s, during the Cold War between U.S. and USSR, that there was the non-aligned movement of countries that say we're not going to be dictated to by the Soviet Union or by the U.S. and that any relationships we have with either will be on our own terms, and that the central focus is to look forward. I remember Kwame Nkrumah said it is not to look left or look east or look west, is to look forward, is what he said. And so the principled task is the people of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and that those, as much as we can, the countries, whether they're socialist or not, really need to embark on a movement that tethers itself away from Western countries and Western imperialism. So that has to be the first program.
Southern African Development Community, SADC, has deployed troops in member state Mozambique to combat terrorism. These regional troops have been successful in drastically reducing terrorist attacks in the country's Cabo Delgado province. Speaking during a SADC summit, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the regional economic bloc cannot allow terrorism to thrive in member states.
We are cognizant of the magnitude of ground that still needs to be covered in the work that we have to do. Therefore, we cannot let our guard down. Terrorism cannot be permitted to continue to thrive in any part of our region.
Our last question to you, Mr. Freeman. Now, we have seen a relatively successful story of combating terrorism in Mozambique through collaboration among regional countries. Now, can these be replicated elsewhere in Africa, especially in West Africa?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to admit, I'm not completely familiar with the programs itself, but it has to be replicated on the rest of the African continent. The Africa needs unity, and it needs a unity that that does not rely, depend on, or take directions from the Western countries like the U.S. or any place in Western Europe. And I consider the U.S. as an extension of Europe. It's a settler colony. It's an extension of Europe. And this agenda is the continuation of colonialism. It's what we call neocolonialism. So the only way forward, no country in the continent of Africa, and this was already laid out perfectly by Kwame Nkrumah in a number of books, particularly his book called The Challenge of the Congo, where he talks about, in that book, talking about how no individual African state can expect to succeed and go things alone without collaboration, full collaboration and a strategic program with the other surrounding countries within the African continent. It is an imperative that countries in Africa replicate cooperation, but also cooperation that is not that rejects the designs and the interests of the Western countries.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Freeman for his analysis, and as he said, intra-Africa collaboration devoid of meddling by Western powers is critical in solving the security challenges facing the continent. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the latest developments in Mali.
Conspiring against Mali.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Mali's government says it recently thwarted an attempted coup led by army officers and supported by an unnamed Western state.
In a statement, Mali's government spokesperson, Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga, said a small group of anti-progressive Malian officers and non-commissioned officers attempted a coup in the night of May 11 to 12, 2022. The attempted coup came amid rising tension between Mali and its former colonial power, France. Mali has revoked a military agreement with France while boosting defense cooperation with Russia.
Now, all these decisions have not gone down well with the authorities in Paris. The row between the two countries further escalated after the military-led government in Mali blamed France for violating the country's airspace.
The government of the Republic of Mali.
Since the beginning of the year, the government of the Republic of Mali has noted more than 50 deliberate cases of violation of Malian airspace by foreign aircraft, particularly those operated by French forces.
Now, for more on frequent reports that France is conspiring against the government in Mali, we contacted Mustafa Traore, a Malian academic and political analyst and the founder of An Open Eye to RG. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, our first question to you, is France conspiring against the government of Mali?
The thing is that there's a correlation between the presence of the French army in some zones, in some regions, and attacks. Whenever you have the French army flying a zone, a few days after, what people have noticed is that you have terrorists coming and attacking. So regarding this very specific case, it is very surprising that the French are not saying, they are not asking questions about who killed these people, because they know that if we check, if we do some medical checking, what is going to be revealed is that these people were assassinated a long time ago.
Mali's media regulator has ordered a definitive suspension of major French government-owned media outlets, France 24 Television and RFI Radio. Were these French media organizations working behind the scene against Mali's government?
Because there is a close link between these two media and the French government. They are, in fact, state media. They are sponsored, the subsidies they get are from the French government. So it is as if you had the French army and all the reports, all the things they were saying about Mali was not in favor of the Malian army. When there is success achieved by the Malian army, then you have nothing written on it. But each time you have people dying, or a mistake done, And also, there is a problem of disinformation.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 to allegedly counter militants that Paris claims are linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. There have been two military coups in roughly a year amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence. Early May, Mali announced that it is cutting off its military cooperation with the French government, condemning flagrant violations of its national sovereignty by the French forces. Government spokesman Colonel Abdoulaye Maïga made the announcement on national TV.
For some time now, the government of the Republic of Mali notes with regret a profound deterioration in military cooperation with France. The government of the Republic of Mali has decided to denounce the Defense Cooperation Treaty of July 16, 2014.
The French Army's chief of staff described this decision as illegitimate. France is now seen as imposing itself on Mali.
France is trying to impose itself on Mali, but today we have to admit that France does not have the strength to do so anymore. So that's the big change. Things have changed, and the time when France could impose its decisions on the Malian people, on the nation, is finished. This time is over.
The move to end military cooperation between France and Mali was greeted with jubilation in Bamako.
France must leave Mali. France is here to steal the resources of Mali. France is here to colonize Mali. Leave the country without delay. They have been here for 10 years and could not solve the problem.
In our tradition, if there is a broom, it means we don't want any more. We don't want any more. The broom means that. That's why we put a stop to France.
Now, can you elaborate on the factors or reasons behind Mali's decision to end its military cooperation with France?
They have all the arguments. The Malians, they put on the table all the arguments they have just to justify, okay, this happened, so there was violation on the agreement by the French first when they decided to leave the country without noticing the Malian government or without speaking with the Malian government about it. So it was in the media that the Malians learned about the fact that the French had decided to leave the country.
Now, curiously, after the decision by Mali to end its military pact with France, there has been an increase in terrorist attacks in these West African countries. Now, Mr. Traoré, are these attacks instigated by external factors to pressurize the authorities in Bamako to let French-led West African forces continue their presence in these mineral-rich West African states?
The terrorists, they had equipment. They had guns, machine guns, that are French ones, that were provided by the French. And this is why, in fact, the Mali has doubts now concerning the French army, and this is what they're asking them to leave. Because how come the French, and the French admitted it, they said, okay, they gave some of the weapons or some of the equipment they gave to this organization, Le Ménila, and did in the hands of the terrorists. How can you explain this one? You gave weapons. You do not give weapons to the Malian army. You give it to a separatist group. And then we see that the weapons, they end in the hands of the terrorists. And this is, in fact, why France cannot say anything at the UN, because we have all, the Malians have all documents. It's all documented.
Togo's president, Farna Singbe, has agreed to act as a mediator between Mali and Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. In March, ECOWAS demanded the organization of elections in Mali within 12 to 16 months.
But Mali's ruling junta rejected the demand and launched a two-year transition process before elections are held. Now, let's see what Mr. Traoré says on these mediation efforts and if there are chances of success.
What I understand is that Togolese president is in good terms with the Malian authorities. Togo is the only country trying to listen and understand the Malians. So this is one fact. The president of Mali, Assimi Goïta, he decided to go and ask the Togolese to try to work as a mediator between the ECOWAS and Mali, because none of all these other countries, part of ECOWAS, are willing to listen to what the Malians are saying. Malians are very simple. They say security first, total recovery of the country in terms of borders, and then elections.
Well, thanks as always to our guest Mustafa Traoré for his great insight on the situation in Mali. We shall keep our eyes focused on Mali and give you analysis of the situation as it unfolds. Well, and that brings us to the end of this edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
By sending prophets, Allah has favored us with the blessings of His teachings, so that we may be guided toward the path which is Allah's right path, and whole world be upon the path of fortune and salvation, and people pass the life of this world with correct training and peace, and turn all the existing attentions in this world toward attention of oneness of Allah. All movements or actions, whether of the heart or of thoughts or body parts, if they are against this appointed path of Allah, then they will be satanic. Thus there is no third path besides these two paths, the path of Satan and the path of Allah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that today the dear Islam is entrusted to us. You should keep it and hand it over to the future generations. According to this saying of Imam Khomeini, he is truly talking about a major topic, and that is that today we have Islam in our hands. Today we are the Muslims and we need to transfer this to our next generations. Unfortunately, we as parents do not have the good education about the Islam. We do not know about Islam. We are just practicing. Why? Because we were in the Muslim country, we have seen people practicing it. But the point which Imam Khomeini is making is that you should keep it and hand it over to the future generation. Now, the question is how to hand over to the next generation. Obviously, the kids who are born in our houses, in a Muslim house, is becoming a Muslim. Now, how to hand over this? It depends. It depends whether the parents are educated or not, whether they do have enough knowledge about the religion or not, whether the beliefs that they have, do they believe on that because it was from their parents, or they have gotten the knowledge and they have the reasons and the proofs of following Islam. This is what we need to follow.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala.
In the Quran, there are many times that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has used the word afala ta'aqilun, afala tatafakkarun. Don't you understand? Don't you ponder? Now, this pondering and understanding is in order to get the knowledge of Islam. If we are praying, if we believe in one God, if we are monotheists, why there is one God? What is the proof? Do we have the reason why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has sent 124,000 prophets? Why He made 12 imams? Why we need to follow them? These are all questions that we have. And if we have the answers of them, if we can explain it truly to our kids from when they're a child, so they will follow it with the firm belief. They will follow the Islam with the firm belief. And that's what we need to do. The handing over the next generation, the future generations, this Islam means to understand Islam, to convey the message of Islam, to convey the teachings of Islam. And obviously, in order to convey the teachings of Islam, it is not only the duty of the scholars to do that who are in the mosques or Husseinia, but rather the first person whose duty is to convey this is the parents, that they should educate themselves first and then they should convey it to their next generation, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Gaza Strip has been suffering a crisis and difficult humanitarian circumstances. Israel started two wars on Gaza that resulted in destroying the infrastructure and ruining most fields. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived two eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the faculty of journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%. And the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalists syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the call.